Okay, we're on. Trying to put this.
Would you like to sit right here?
Okay. I think this is the most disorganized group that I've ever worked with. Usually you all sit nicely where we want you to, and now you're sitting wherever you want to, which is really not fair. Anyway, welcome to all of you, and I'd like to say that I want to be sure to let you know that the Romneys are hosting with us, and we are very much appreciative of John and Cherie, and they're helping us with the hosting tonight. And you have met Sandra and Sean, all of you, I hope. It's a very tender moment for me to have Sean and Sandra in our home. Sandra and I go back over 50 years when we have done so many very, very wonderful things together. We have sat on the floor in London and talked through the night, and in Belfast and talked through the night, and all through Ireland, where we were going to crash around any curve. Stephen was driving the Jaguar at 60 miles an hour, and there was no vision around the corner. And I said to Stephen, "Aren't you a little worried about an accident?" And he said that the Lord will protect us, and the Lord did protect us. So we had wonderful memories. And during dinner, it's been really fun to get to know Sean again. And one thing that I'd forgotten and he remembered, which was very tender to me, was that the other guys at Hebgen were really good water skiers, and I never was a good water skier. I skied, but I hit a boat once and kind of threw my knee out.
It's hard as ever since you can't do any gardening.
So I thought maybe I could do something that I knew, and that was sailing. So we bought an Aquacat, and that was not exciting enough. So then we bought a Hobiecat, and that was really exciting. And Sean told me tonight, when he was 15, I gave him his first lesson on the Hobiecat. And then he learned how to tip it up on its side and flip it over, and then how to face in the wind and pull it up. And so that was a tender remembrance. There's great love that exists here in this room with me and these wonderful Covey people. In terms of people who have influenced me over the years, I can very honestly say that my mother and Stephen Covey have been the strongest influence for good in my life. Stephen has spent countless hours, and Sandra too, with me and talking and advising and counseling, writing letters, and I think if I had a quarter for every minute I've spent with you and your husband, I could retire as a very rich man now, because there was no watching the clock whenever we were with you. There was gold in those discussions, and we couldn't think of calling them off because we were too much involved in enjoying them too much.
We learned as much from you, Clay.
No, I'm sure you didn't, but Stephen has been to some of you here and to me a real fun, crazy guy. And he's also been as inspirational as anybody could be. And I have had a lot of friends in my life, and there's only one friend that I've told everything. everything about me in this world, and that friend was Stephen Covey. I shared everything, all my secrets with Stephen.
Well, I'd like to know some of them.
Well, I can tell you a few.
But if you, when you go home, get your computer out and go to the internet and look up Stephen R. Covey and look up Sean Covey, and you will find page after page of extraordinary accomplishments and blessings that these people have been in terms of their careers. Great teachers, great motivators, great family people. So we have wonderful, wonderful memories, and you'll enjoy reading about these two people on the internet. I think Sean has done at least 10 books, right? Or 12?
About
that. 10 or 12 books, plus doing wonderful teaching and inspiring and motivating.
And I'll have to say, as his mother, he's been on the New York Times
bestseller.
Bestsellers. He's a really good writer. He's an English major.
No bias.
Oh. An English major? I knew you weren't an engineer. Anyway, so his father and Sean have followed on the same path, and it's been a great path in terms of contributing to the world. And I just want to say that I've asked Sean to tell us about this wonderful human being, his father. And in my family, I've become the keeper of the flame in the Williams family, and I'm doing that history. And I understand you, Sandra, have done a wonderful story of your family, a 4 or 5 hour film. Well, Roger's been so wonderful with me in terms of putting together the history of the Williamses and the Hardys and so forth. And so I invited Sean tonight, realizing that he was extremely busy. In fact, he has a wedding of his oldest in 2 days. Hard to be able to find a date that we could agree on. And so I wanted to have Stephen's legacy continue in any situation that I could help in. And I know Doug's been working on that at Utah State. And there's a contribution being made there in the presidential chair that Stephen Covey occupied for 2.5 years at the Utah State University. So, without further ado, I would like to introduce a wonderful young man, Sean Covey.
Thank you. Okay. Well, good evening. This is so great to be with you. Thank you for having me. My beautiful mom. Isn't she a great sport? My mom hates being in a wheelchair. And she's been, how long have you been?
About 5 years.
About 5 years. And you wouldn't know it because she does everything. She's at every event. She goes to BYU basketball games, never misses one. All the kids' sporting events. And I just adore my mother and hope I can grow up to be like her. So the two most influential people in my life, Clay, are probably the same two people. My dad and my mom. So anyhow, thank you for having me. And this is the Great People Group, right?
Yeah. We named ourselves.
I think it's great. It's self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
It used to be Great Minds.
Great Minds? So I have a proposal for you. Why don't you call yourself the Great Souls?
Yes.
Anyhow, so I know a few of you, and I've been working with Doug Anderson just recently on the Stephen R. Covey Center. Leadership up at Utah State. It looks like we've got a lot of people. We have all the three universities represented here, it looks like, right? We've got Utah State, BYU, and Utah. So that's good. We're well balanced. Okay, so tonight I thought I would
just share a few thoughts about my dad. As was mentioned by Clay, I've got my oldest son. I have 8 kids, so my wife and I are tired. Our oldest is 24, Michael Sean. He's getting married on Friday, Salt Lake Temple. He was lined up by my sister, so lineups do really work sometimes. And my youngest is 5. His name is Wyatt. When I was 40, I had a midlife crisis. And most people, when they have a midlife, will buy a Camaro, you know, a convertible. I had a baby and named him after a cowboy, Wyatt Earp. And so my youngest is 5, and I'm thinking about my son getting married on Friday. I'm excited about the marriage, but the idea of being a grandpa freaks me out. I am not ready to be a grandfather and be married to a grandma. So I'm going to tell my son, at least 5 years, wait 5 years. Wait till Wyatt is at least 10 before you have a baby, because I'm not ready. I'm still raising children.
I recommend it, by the way.
That's what I hear. But psychologically, I got to get there. Well, I thought I'd just share a few minutes. I've got about 3 hours, so we'll be done around 11:30.
Sounds good.
I'll just take a few minutes. And Clay asked me to talk a little bit about my father, and I've written down some notes I wanted to share with you. And the other day, or not the other day, but about 8 months ago, when he passed away, I just sat down one day and I wrote down a whole bunch of things that I wanted to remember about my dad. I wrote down, what did I learn from my dad that I wanted to perpetuate? What do I want to do different? What would I like to leave behind? I have a big list of things I want to perpetuate, a couple of things I want to leave behind. And then how can I best honor my dad? How can I best honor his life? What will I miss most about my father? I wrote down some of these. I wanted to share some of these with you. And my dad was raised, he went to East High School with some of you. Who else went to East? Like a lot of people here went to East. So East was the place to go. And we look at his childhood, and me and my siblings think his childhood is a mystery, because there's only a few things we know. And I'm sure you guys could fill in all the blanks, right? But he used to tell just a few stories about how he used to play marbles, and he claims that he took 3rd in the nation in marbles.
He did.
Yeah, we don't have any other evidence besides
no trophies.
He had a bone disease in his legs. He had to get 2 6-inch nails in both of his femurs. And he was on crutches for several years in high school. And he said it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because he said, I was a goof-off, I love sports, and I got into books. And got into debate and academics. And he said, that changed my life. So he looks on that as a great blessing. And he tells a lot of funny stories about his childhood. He said that he had one friend in particular. His name was Stephen Love. Huh. You know Stephen Love?
Oh, yes, I do.
But all of his stories had to do with Stephen Love. And he told about one story when he was probably around 10 years old, and John was 7, and Stephen Love was one of the neighborhood kids, and there were 5 or 6 other kids, and they had a club. And they had comic books they would all share. And one day, all the comic books were missing. So they held a court, and they found Stephen Love guilty of ripping off the comic books. Actually, it was Uncle John, my uncle, that had stolen the comic books. But he was one of the judges, and he condemned him. And the punishment was everyone would give him the silent treatment for the whole summer. And Stephen Love climbed a tree and jumped out of it and broke both of his legs.
Oh.
It's kind of and so that's one of the great stories he tells. I said, Dad, don't you have any other stories about your childhood besides that one? Kind of a mystery growing up. One of the things that's intriguing about my father is how he got into his career, because his dad ran the Little America Hotel. So my great-grandfather was the guy in Wyoming, Stephen Matt Covey, who was on the plains of Wyoming, and I think you know the story. And he was freezing to death in a blizzard, and he knelt down and he prayed, and he said, Lord, please save my life. If you do, I promise you, I will build a refuge right here where I am for weary travelers like me.
so that no one experiences what I'm going through right now. Well, he made it through the night, sold a lot of sheep, he was a shepherd, and built that first Little America Hotel in the plains of Wyoming, which is the biggest, one of the biggest truck stops in the country right now. And then came down here to Salt Lake and built this hotel here, and then passed it on to his son. My grandfather was running this hotel. And my dad was sent to Harvard Business School to be the next manager of the Little America. He was groomed to do that. But while he was on his mission in England, he discovered he loved to teach. And he had a mission president that said, you know what, you're really good at communication. And so he came home from his mission and saw his life differently. And he said, I want to be a teacher. And my Uncle John said, well, what do you want to do with your life? And he said, I don't want to run the hotel, John. I want to unleash human potential. But he had to tell his dad. He was so fearful what his dad might say. So he came back after getting his degree that my grandfather paid for from Harvard. And he said, okay, are you ready to run the hotel? He said, no, Dad, I don't want to do that. Well, what is it you want to do? He said, I want to be a teacher. And he kind of leaned back and he said, you know, I never liked business that much either.
Well, you know what he really said is people that teach, they teach because they can't do anything else.
That's what he said when he was younger. But yeah, so he became a teacher. And he loved to teach. My dad was a phenomenal teacher. And so he taught at BYU for many years, and then he started doing consulting on the side, and he started inventing these habits and doing research and observations and studies about what made people effective, what made teams work, you know, what made organizations effective, and that's where he came up with these 7 habits of highly effective people, which is still one of the best-selling books of all time today and still on the New York Times bestseller list. So he was a great, insightful teacher, but he found his voice. And if he were here tonight, his message was always to everybody, you know, find your voice and inspire others to find theirs. Everybody has a purpose, a unique contribution you can make in your family that may be very different than what anyone else can do. And that you will feel called and will feel energy in it. You'll identify your unique contribution and your mission. I remember being at the BYU, or at the MTC, Missionary Training Center, in Provo one time. And there were about 250 branch presidents in attendance. And he was training them on empathic listening, how to listen effectively. And he was role-playing. And he said, okay, when you listen, you need to reflect back how the other person is feeling. Don't try to interpret, don't try to judge, evaluate, criticize, just reflect how they're feeling. He was trying to teach them this, and he'd walk around and he was role-playing the role of a teenager who didn't want to go to school anymore and wanted to drop out. And he was going around to each of the branch presidents and saying like, oh, Dad, you know, I just don't feel like going to school anymore. You know, Joe left school early, he's making a lot of money. And then he'd go to the branch president, okay, you're the father, reflect back. And the father would say, well, if you drop out of school, you're not gonna get an education, you're not gonna have a good job down there. And you know, he'd say, no, you're judging. And he'd go around person by person, and you could see the frustration building. No one could get it right. And it took about 30 minutes before they finally started to capture this idea of how to listen to your spouse, to your friend, you know, to a child that's struggling, how to listen empathically, because we're so conditioned to jump in and to respond, you know, without really reflecting understanding. And it was the most amazing teaching experience I've ever seen. The room was completely transformed. It was on the border of chaos, and then all of a sudden there's this great breakthrough. And I sat back in the back of the room and said, oh my goodness, I cannot believe what I just experienced. That was the most profound teaching experience I've ever seen. And I want to follow in his footsteps. I want to be part of what he's doing. Remember, I made up my mind at that point because of he was such a great teacher. And that room was transformed. I thought to myself, they will never listen to their teenage son in the same way again. They will never talk with their spouse in the same way again. This was an incredible experience. So my dad was a very forgiving person. Early in the days of Covey Leadership Center, when he began the company, he was 55, tenured professor at BYU, and he decided to go off on his own and start this new company. He didn't like business. He liked to teach. But he took the gamble, and the first president of the company was a good friend of his. He started the company. At one point, about 5 years into the business, this person tried to create a coup, basically, against my father, and got a lot of other people involved, and just because he wanted more power, and he wanted more equity, and so forth. And it was a really disturbing thing, and it took months to work out. And eventually, the board sided with my father, and this person was kicked out. But my dad would never say anything bad about him. I watched this. He never said anything bad. He said, I could stand in the prayer circle with him right now. I have no ill feelings. He made a mistake. I forgive him. And this person, who was so bad to him for so many years, really tried to destroy his company, would come to my dad for blessings through the years as he was struggling with different things. And I was always just so amazed at how he was always so careful. He said, I can't speak if I don't have integrity. So when Clinton was president, our family is quite conservative. My mom has got us all to be quite excited about politics. And so we'd always bash Clinton quite a bit. And mom would join in. It was great. We'd talk about all his faults and all the things he was doing wrong. And we'd go, come on, Dad, what do you think? And he goes, I can't say anything bad about him because I might have the chance to influence him. And he said that for 3 years. And then one day we were up at Sundance at my parents' cabin, and we got a call from the White House. And he said, this is the White House, and this is President Clinton. I was wondering if you could come out and train me for a couple of days. I love your 7 habits. So he went out to Camp David, spent 2 days with Bill and Hillary, and he said Bill was actually a brilliant man. You could name any president, and he'd go back in history and tell you exactly what they believed on every topic. He had a sharp memory. And he spent 2 days training him on influence and the 7 habits and leadership and so forth. And he could do it with total integrity because all those years he never said anything negative about him. And so it was a great lesson for us kids to watch him and the way he just would never speaks evil of another person or poorly of another person. So a lot of great integrity.
Fun to be around. He never talked about anybody.
I know, so it was a good balance in our home. So Dad was always trying to teach us principles, you know. So people always ask, what was it like growing up in the 7 Habits home? And the answer is, you know, our home was pretty normal. We had fights. We had problems. We had setbacks. The good thing my parents did is they always tried again, right? We'd always set a new set of goals. We blew that last set, but let's try again and set a new set of goals. And he was, you know, always teaching us about integrity and principles. And like I'd come home from school and say, oh, man, Dad, I'm going to flunk algebra. And it's my teacher's fault. He's the worst. And he'd always come to me and say, check out your language. You're going to flunk algebra. And it's your teacher's fault. That's called victim. And if you have a problem with your teacher, go talk with your teacher and resolve the issue. And I'd say, Dad, you're so weird. Where's Mom? And I'd go to Mom and I'd say, Mom, my teacher makes me so mad. She goes, yeah, let's get him. So Dad was always loyal. He was loyal to you or to principals. Mom was loyal to you. So it was a good balance in our home. But my dad was quick to forgive. There were a lot of, in academia, there are sometimes problems and politics and pettiness and so forth. And
this is a very great surprise.
Yeah, you probably know a little bit about that. And there were some really hard things he had to endure, sometimes from people he thought were his friends, and but I just saw the way he was so quick to forgive and to make up and not to hold grudges and so forth, and it was a great thing. My dad was so affirming of people. He always made you feel, he'd walk into the room and he'd go, "Oh, Sean, it's great to see you. I haven't seen you for hours. How are you?" I remember one time there was a BYU football game, and he'd make whatever was important to you, he would make important to him. So when I was in high school, I remember one time hearing him on the phone to Provo City saying, "Well, I need to plan ahead. When are the Provo High football games?" "Well, Mr. Covey, it's 14 months away. We don't have the schedule yet." "I know, but can't you get the schedule? When are you going to have it?" And he would, because he traveled a lot, but he would make sure he was always there for my games. So when I was playing at BYU one time, he had a trip overseas, he had a big speech, he had a private jet fly him back, and he got there 1 hour before the game. I was hoping he'd come. I saw him up in the stands, and he waved. I said, "All right, Dad's there." And I played the worst game of my life. Remember Jason Buck?
Mm-hmm.
He was on the opposing team. This was a BYU JV game, and he was playing for Ricks College. He was on the opposing team, and he was killing me the whole game. I threw like 4 interceptions. It was the worst game of my life. And I was so dejected. After the game, he waited for me, came out of the locker room, and he gave me a big hug. He said, "John, that was the best game I've ever seen you play." I said, "Dad, we lost 40-14. I threw 4 interceptions." He said, "I know, but you were so tough. You were getting killed out there today, and you kept getting back up. I've never been so proud of you." And I thought to myself, there's no way anyone could make me feel good about what happened, but somehow he did. So he had this great ability to affirm people.
Sean, I just want to ask you a question. In his story about the Clean and green.
Yeah.
Were you the son?
That was Stephen, my older brother.
I just wondered.
Yeah, that's a famous story.
It is famous.
And my brother's version of that is that he was only 8 years old and he was framed. Yeah. So my dad was a lot of fun too. So he could be serious and he could be very immature. Right, Mom?
Right.
And John Creer, I was just telling a story at my table. John Creer, do you know John Creer?
Yes.
John Preston Creer. They're best friends. But when you get them around each other, they become like 15-year-olds. And so they were always playing practical jokes on each other. One time, my dad was speaking at a conference, and John was there supporting him, and they were in the restroom, and John was in one of the bathroom stalls. And my dad turned on the faucet and just started grabbing water and throwing it over the bathroom stalls. And just soaking John. Remember that, Mom?
Well, Stephen was
speaking
at the graduation.
Yeah. Oh. And so, and John, you know, comes out all soaking wet, and they just do that kind of crazy stuff with each other. He loved to embarrass us kids, so he'd show up at school lunch when we were in grade school and start singing songs in the lunch line. I remember I was in 4th grade, Wasatch Elementary. He came to lunch. I said, "Dad, you're not supposed to be here at lunch. It's okay." He goes, and then we were sitting in line, and he started singing, "I love my family." And he's going, "Oh, Dad, you're killing me." So my dad, because he traveled so much, and he would, when he traveled, he'd speak. He'd say, "Just book me." And so we'd get him for an interview at 7 o'clock in the morning, then a luncheon with somebody important, and then he'd go and speak for 4 hours, and then he'd do a lunch with somebody else and go speak again, and then do a fireside that night, and then he'd do it again the next day, and he'd go for 2 weeks straight often. So he was good at taking naps whenever he could. He'd carry around his eye shades, and he would just take a nap wherever, he'd go to a movie and take a nap on the floor, under trees, by sidewalks, just wherever. So one time my sister Jenny told me a story about being in Europe. He was going to a very important speech with like several thousand people. He was on a train, his train car. And he was so tired, he just laid down on the aisle. He'd wad up his coat and just took a nap. And these people came and stepped over him, kind of like a homeless guy, you know, and sat down. And Jenny is sitting there by my dad, who's sleeping in front of her. And the two people, she overhears him, "Oh, I can't wait to hear Stephen Covey today. I hear his presence is incredible. Yeah, I just hear he's amazing. His book has changed my life. And my sister's sitting there thinking, little do they know that there's Stephen Covey sleeping in the aisle of the train car. So, anyhow, I think my father's strength came from his practice of what he called the daily private victory. And he felt that if your motive was right and pure, and if you got it aligned to God's will for you and paid the price to do that, that your whole being would be full of light. And so he was always so good at going deep within himself. He always taught there's three sides to a person. There's your public life, what people see you do. There's your private life, what you do when you're alone. And then there's your inner life, which is your really deep self, where your motives lie and your desires, where you observe your private and your public life and decide what you want to become. And so his strength came from what he called his daily private victory. Every morning, on most mornings, he'd get up early. He would study the scriptures. He would review his mission. He always felt he had a unique mission to the world. And he would pray and kind of review his day, how he wanted it to go. So he'd blueprint the day. He'd see himself challenged. He'd see himself being patient. He'd see himself in tough situations, and he'd see himself overcoming those. And so he had this ability to blueprint his day and get centered. And this is where his strength came from, his power and his energy, to affirm people, to love people, to forgive, to speak from the heart, to connect with people. And he taught us kids, he used to say, if you'll spend 20 minutes each day with the Savior of this world in private worship, you can spend eternity in his presence. In other words, this practice of getting close to God every day will keep you close enough to him that eventually you can be with him forever. So he taught us, we developed a family mission statement as the family. Remember that, Mom? Many years ago? And we all got together as a big family. And he said, okay, what is our family all about? What do we want to become? And we'd talk about it, and we came up with a proposal. He said, John, what do you think our family mission statement is? And I said, we're one hell of a family, and we kick butt. All right, that's a good one. And so we all came up with statements, and eventually we came up with a family mission statement. And it changed a couple of times, but no one really cared about what the statement was. What we did care about is the idea that we came together and we formed something and we stood for something. So I've done the same thing with my family. We have a family mission statement right here. And my daughter, Rachel, she passed away, but a couple months after my dad passed away this last year. She was 21. So our mission is all about kind of the great reunion we'll have one day, you know, so we can live good lives so we can all be together again. But family was most important to him. And as good as he was in public as a speaker, as a writer, and so forth, he was even better as a father. And that's probably the best compliment I could give him. He was the real deal. He walked his talk. He wasn't perfect. And he had, when he was younger especially, he had a temper. It wasn't the temper that you'd fear, but it was a temper where you'd say, stay away from Dad, he's in the mood. And it especially happened when we'd go on trips. You know, 9 kids, we're going to Hebgen Lake tomorrow in Montana. He'd say, kids, oh, we are going to have the best trip. Tomorrow morning we're getting up at 6. We're going to be packed in the car by 7. We're going to be off by 8. If everybody helps, we can do this. You know, he'd come by about 5:30. Sean, get up. 5:45. Sean, get up. 6 o'clock, get up. 7 o'clock, get up, you boys. And then by about 9 o'clock, we'd all be up. And then no one would work. And then we'd get into the car about 12. And he would be yelling at people, get in the car, you don't do any work. We get in the car, and it was the same story every time. We'd be off by like 2. And then we'd have to stop to go use the bathroom, and we'd get to Pocatello by about 10 p.m. We'd have to stay over Pocatello, make it a 2-day trip. And we'd get to Hebbian the next day like noon. It'd take a day and a half. We didn't realize that it was like a 4.5-hour drive until we got married later on. But he'd always do the same thing. He'd get in the car, he's kind of a little curt with his temper, and he'd be quiet for about an hour. And then all of a sudden he'd kind of say, "Okay, family, I apologize. I lost my temper. Sean, I was short with you, and Jenny, I'm so sorry. Will you guys forgive me?" We'd say, "Yeah, we forgive you." And they'd go, "Okay, not let it ruin our day." And then he'd just be back. He always taught us about this idea of instant repentance. You make a mistake, don't dwell on it, repent fast, and get back into the groove. But he had a temper, and over time he overcame it. And I remember in family home evenings, he used to prepare a long time for lessons. And we'd all gather around, and we'd be laying on the ground, and someone would be sleeping, someone else would be doing their homework. And he'd try to get everyone's attention, we wouldn't give him attention, and he'd storm out of the room and go to the basement. And then Mom would stand up and go, "Kids, Dad's been preparing for 3 weeks for this lesson. Let's go down and get him." So like 3 or 4 of us would go down. We'd say, "Dad, we're all ready to be reverent now. Are you sure?" "Yeah." "Okay." He'd come back up and then he'd teach the lesson. So, anyhow, just a couple of more things and then I'll wrap it up. And I'd love to, if you have any questions, answer any questions you have. My best friend in high school is a guy named Fini Unga, Tongan. And we got to be friends because we played football. And he was came from a really poor home, didn't have anything. And my dad just took him in and was so good to him and just would affirm him and say, "Fini, you're going to go on a mission. And you're going to get married in the temple someday." Fini had a terrible background and situation. And he was so affirming. He became like Feeney's best friend. And Feeney would wear my dad's T-shirts. He'd come to our house. He felt so welcome in our home. He'd come to the house and just go to my dad's drawers and take out some T-shirts he liked. You'd be at school and you'd see Feeney with my dad's T-shirts on. I thought, this is terrific. And then Feeney, when he graduated from high school, he went down to Dixie College to play football. And my dad made him a tape, a 1-hour visualization tape, he called it. And it'd be like this. He'd say, "Feeney, this is Stephen. I'm your best friend. You've got a great life ahead of you, Feeney. You're going to become, you're going to get married in the temple, and you're going to be a missionary." And then he'd say, "Imagine yourself in football," and he'd kind of walk him through a game. And Feeney, many years later, came to me and he said, "Sean, I've listened to that tape every week for the last 5 years. He got married in the temple. He's got 5 kids, beautiful family, beautiful wife. His whole life has been changed, and he credits my father." So interesting, at his funeral, this is what I got. I collected these. These are just emails I got from people from all around the world. And because he was so good with the one, you'd have people come up to you all the time and say things like, "Oh, your dad one time, he was at a meeting, and he told me that I would be the key to changing my family. And I did. And I want to tell you about it. Here's a letter." There were hundreds of those, because he was always he believed in people. And he was always looking for the chance to affirm somebody. When he passed away, this is an article from the New York Times that came out. This is an article from Forbes magazine. This is an article from Washington Post from Tom Peters. Tom Peters said, "Let's forget the content of his books or the gazillions of copies of 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, any of his other books, for that matter, have sold around the world. Let's forget his memorable seminars and his business success. One simply cannot pay tribute to Stephen Covey without saying at the outset that he was a lovely human being." He was good friends with Tom Peters. I'd say, "Dad, tell me about Tom Peters." He goes, "Oh, he's so messed up." he's a great businessman, but boy, his personal life is an absolute wreck. Here's another great one from Simon & Schuster when he passed away. Harvard Business Review. "Stephen R. Covey taught me not to be like him. Meaning, he taught me to achieve my own purpose and my own mission in life." Here's one from The Economist. "The legacy of the author of the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People." And here's one I just wanted to read to you, which is real short. And this is from Clayton Christensen. He's a professor at Harvard. He's an author. He's considered one of the best thinkers in the world on business. And he said this. He said, years ago, an elderly friend asked if I knew another man who studied at the Harvard Business School named Stephen Covey. I replied that I knew of him, though his seven habits of through his seven habits, of course, but had not personally met him. My friend said, well, let me tell you a story about that man, which tells you everything you need to know about Stephen Covey. I was a freshman at Harvard College in 1956. I went to our Mormon church on my first Sunday there, and before I could sit down, young Covey, who himself had just arrived a few weeks earlier to begin his studies at the Harvard MBA program, approached me and asked if I could help him that afternoon at a meeting in downtown Boston. I agreed, and we met at the entrance to the Red Line station in Harvard Square that afternoon. Covey had a heavy bag and a wood box with him. When I asked of their purpose, he replied, we are going to find a busy walkway through Boston Common. I'm going to stand on this box and give a sermon on the life of Jesus Christ. Your job is to invite as many people as possible to stand there to hear my sermon. Then you need to look at their faces, and if they seem interested, give them one of the pamphlets in this bag. I did what I was told. Steve delivered a wonderful sermon to that group of about 50 people. And he used to do that all the time. And when he was a missionary in England, he'd just get on the soapbox and stand up and preach. And that's how they got half their converts, right, Mom? And as a mission president in Ireland, he used to, the missionaries would get off the plane, he'd take them to a public square, he'd put them on a box, and they'd do a street meeting. That was their initiation. And half their referrals came from these street meetings. So he used to do that in Boston. So this was after he returned from his mission. He'd go to Boston Square and he'd preach. He'd do that like three or four times a week. My elderly friend concluded, that event changed my life. He became my idol. While most of his classmates at that time were resting with a beer from their demanding program, Stephen Covey was at a higher work. Stephen Covey changed my life too, as I have gotten to know him well. What he wrote is who he is. Whenever I walk through Boston Common, I imagine Stephen Covey in his early 20s, standing on a wooden box with a clear voice, with a message about his Redeemer, who was his beacon. Stephen was proactive. He began his career with its end in mind, and he put first things first. I am grateful for this man, but I will not miss him. He will continue to be with me every day through the things that he taught me to do. I thought that was a great tribute. Okay, well, so, Mom, do you want to share anything?
I really love the integrity of Stephen. And he was a very forceful person. He could, you know, win every argument with me. Very intellectually, but if he knew he was wrong, in about an hour, he'd come around and he'd say, "You were absolutely right. You know, I'm sorry. I was thinking differently," and so he would always, you know, be open to influence. And but he was a heck of a lot of fun. I mean, my life with him was so exciting and so fun, and we would go on a Honda motorcycle ride every single day. He'd just come and say, "Come on, Sandra, let's go," and we'd drive around real slow around Provo and stop and get a hot dog or a malt or something, and just have this great visit about all the kids and what was going on. And in the winter, we'd do it on a snowmobile, or if we had to, in the car. But every day we had this time together where we'd talk. And my favorite thing is he'd always say, "You know what my favorite thing to do is?" And I'd say, "What?" And he said, "Just be alone with you and talk." And so that was very endearing.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mom and dad have a great marriage, and that was a great example to us. He used to call my mom, he'd say, "Mom, I think," this is with the whole family, "Mom is like a dresser drawer." And she goes, "Well, that's not very romantic, Stephen." "No, but you keep everything organized in my life." She goes, well, can't you come up with something better than a dresser drawer? But my mom used to be in the Tabernacle Choir as a soloist. That's how they met. She was traveling in Europe when he was on his mission there. And he used to love to ask her to sing, just spontaneously, at any event. It didn't matter if it was a church event or just a business event. Be in a crowd of 500 people, and he'd go, Sandra, could you come up here and sing a medley of Irish songs? And my mom would always jump in and get up and sing and knock everyone's socks off. But so let me just say this in closing. My father, it was not about him. He never thought he was better than anybody. He just thought he had a different mission. And he just would always affirm us and say, you have your own unique mission. If you were here today, this is what I know he'd want you to feel from him. One, that he loves you and he cares for you. Two, that you are very important and you have a great purpose and you have you can do so much good in your family. That there's nothing more important than family. Everything else pales in comparison. He used to always quote that no other success can compensate for failure in the home. He'd want you to live life in crescendo, to think about that your best days are ahead of you, and to never retire. You might retire from a job, but not from meaningful projects, and that you've got great symphonies ahead of you still, and they might come in the form of a grandchild or some important thing you feel called to do. So in his final hours, my dad passed away at the Idaho Falls. We were up at Hebgen Lake, and he woke up unresponsive one morning. This all happened pretty fast. He had a bike accident a few months before, never really recovered from that. In his final hours, we had the whole family around. We were able to get everyone together before he passed away, which was a great blessing. And I had prayed months before that he'd be lucid in his last moments. And he was out of it the whole day. He couldn't talk or anything. And suddenly, in his last hour, he woke up. He couldn't talk because he had a breathing tube, but we all had about 10 minutes with him as couples. And it was fabulous. It was so neat. He understood everything. He knew he was dying, and we all talked with him, and it was a beautiful thing. And I thought to myself, I hope I can go that way with all of my family around me. And he had paid the price to have a great relationship with each one of us. And sometimes there were some ups and downs, especially when we were teenagers, but he was always there, and we had this great relationship. So I hope that I have that same kind of relationship with
my kids. And then we sang kids. Songs around for about 15 minutes.
Yeah. And afterwards, we all felt it was so interesting that he went so fast because he had a healthy heart. He thought he might be around another 10 years. He always wanted to make it to his 80th birthday, and he would get in. In some of his speeches, he'd often say, imagine your 80th birthday, and imagine your friends and your colleagues and loved ones around you. What would you want them to say about you? And then he'd say, live your life accordingly. So he passed away when he was 79. So on his 80th birthday, we all got together at my mom's house, and we all went around and gave tributes to my father. It was a great thing. Anyhow, I think we were so curious about him passing away so fast, and then my daughter Rachel passed away just a couple months later, and they had a really good relationship. And I'm convinced he went to help her. It's clear as day to help receive her and to help her transition. And just like him, you know. And I know I've come to believe that was something that was all in the plan. And so anyway, we feel like he's now my daughter's shepherd in this new world. So
maybe Sean, tell about his last moments when he opened up his eyes. And
yeah, go ahead.
Well, we'd sung songs and we'd all each had a chance to be with him alone and pour our hearts out and tell him our love. And right before he died, it was just, we took the breathing tube out, and it was just the last few breaths, and all of a sudden his eyes opened up, and he started looking up, and he looked from one side of the room really slowly all the way across to the other side of the room, And we all knew that he was seeing, you know, people. And one of my, Maria said, "Reveal yourselves," because we all wanted to see these angels that we knew were there to receive him. And it was just amazing. I mean, it was just so obvious, you know. And then he just kind of took his last breath and died. But it wasn't sad.
It wasn't sad. It was a great, beautiful thing, actually. So, anyhow, so my dad was immortal. He had faults and flaws like all of us. His testimony was always this. And Dr. Cummins talks about you need to be valiant in the testimony of Jesus. And he said, what that means to me is not only are you obedient to his commandments, but you're valiant in what he thinks of you. You know, what is Christ's testimony of us? He believes in us. He believes we can do anything. He believes we're capable. He believes we're strong. He believes we can change and overcome. So he said, you know, to be valiant in the testimony of Jesus Christ means you believe in how he sees you. And that's what he was all about. So thanks a lot for having me tonight. It's good to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you, thank you. Do any of you have any questions for Sean you'd like to ask?
I don't have a question, but I come from a different perspective. I knew Stephen Covey at BYU during the early 70s as a student.
Yeah.
And there are certain professors at BYU as a student when you're a little 18, 19-year-old co-ed coming there, you know, and there's Hugh Nibley and Reed, I can't even remember the name, Steve Covey, and you're just like, oh, yeah. You know, like you're going to the Celestial Room and seeing these professors. And I'll never forget your dad one time was speaking at a student ward. And I was in the audience, and he was pretty intense to a young student. You know,
yeah.
He would go to the podium, and he had a very quiet, intense voice. And your mom was in the back with all these little kids. In the middle of his talk, she got up and was dragging one kid under this arm, and, you know, one under this arm, and two behind with her skirt, and going out the back door, and your dad stopped. And he said, "Don't leave, my love." And your mom turned around and said, "Okay, fine. You come get the kids and I'll give the talk." It's like, go, Sister Covey!
That's good. Yes.
Our stories with Stephen are fabulous. Betty and I probably did 300 or 400 double dates.
Yeah.
With Stephen.
You could destroy him.
And and I told Sandra tonight, maybe I'll pen these out sometime.
Well, that'd be
she
great.
Said, we'd love to hear these stories because they're really very interesting.
Yeah.
But then he became the mission president, heard Sandra's voice in the chorus, fell in love with Sandra, all the rest was past. He was easy for Sandra to say, "I'm the one."
Yeah.
And she was. That was great.
Yeah, he was.
But he was a
practical joker.
Classical talent. I just mentioned one thing. Some of you may remember G. Homer Durham.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. G. Homer Durham was brilliant.
Submission brother, right?
Yeah. I think he was, among other things. I think he became president of
ASU
after. But we were down at Stephen's home on Third South, and his mother came out and said, "Howard, I want to show you something." And she showed us, he was a tough professor. Mm. I mean, he really was, but he was good. And she brought this blue book, and in the back of it, it said, "Dear Mrs. Covey, this is the most well-written blue book test I have ever read." Girl.
That's great.
He was a bright guy.
Yeah.
Well, wow.
Yeah, he was bright.
Well, and Howard, he's told us so many of the stories of you guys and the funny things that you did, so our kids know a lot of them by heart.
Yeah. If you have any more Stephen Love stories you need to tell us. Still trying to find that guy and see how his legs are doing.
One thing I'd like to add is that...
it's a horrible story.
In all the time that we had with Stephen and Sandra, and there were hours and hours and hours that we talked. I mean, it's just everywhere. London, Ireland, Montana, Utah, everywhere. And we all sat on the floor. We sat, and there was not one time ever that Stephen said, you know, I'm tired, let's call it an end. He never was the one to end it. It was always his interest in the rest of us and what he could do for us and what he wanted to help us with. But never one time was he, I'm tired. It was always. And I would like to say for the rest of you who wouldn't know this but would expect it, that Sandra now has 9 missionaries in the field.
Wow. Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I have about 10 grandchildren already go. So we, all of our girls go as well as the boys. Oh. All of our children, the girls went and the boy as well as the boys. And same thing with our granddaughters and with our grandkids.
But it's 9 at one time right now. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I just want to quickly say that I just loved Stephen. He influenced my life. I knew him before he got married, and he was the older brother that was kind of around all the time. But and then I go down to the education weeks and always seek out his classes. But I thought he was brilliant. I thought he was inspiring. I thought he was so fun. Great personality. He had a huge personality, and he just encompassed everyone into his life, into his arms, and he was uplifting. And he was just one of a kind and extraordinary.
Yep. Hey, so thanks for having me, Clay.
Thank you, Sean. I think we've got a chip off the old block here.
This guy taught me how to sail. That's very important. It's very important.
Well, sailing is very important. Anyway, thanks to all of you for coming, and Sandra especially for you making the effort. We love you, and we always have. Thank you.
And you geniuses who figured out how I could get in.
Yeah, now, but Mom, getting out is going to be harder. I wouldn't say that yet.
Anyway, great to be with all of you. I recorded this for my son Clay, who said he wanted to be sure to hear what Sean had to say about his dad, so it's all right in here. So this is the end of it.